Accession number 32394, Mr. Don Farrington, real fine. Now, after that, your period as an instructor, you go to Wingan Wimpy, 26 Operational Training Unit at Wingan Wimpy. I don't know where that is. And that's in June 1943. Where is Wingan Wimpy?
It's just Wing, actually. It's down south somewhere, but I can't tell you now whereabouts it was in those days.
And what was it like there? What was happening there? It's 26 OTU. What were you doing there?
Well, just hang on a second.
So that's where you're going to form the crew. Now, how do you go about that?
Well, the first of all, it's the pilots who are looking for crews. And by the time I got there, they were just a wireless operator short. They came over to me on this particular occasion and asked me if I'd been, you know, I would be interested in joining them. And I said, oh yes, I would, please. So the idea being that we would have a training session where all the other members of the crew that were okay and been finalised, I'd have to go through my procedure with the wireless. And, you know, and he asked me all about my training. And, of course, having been trained for so long, it stood me in very good stead.
He said, oh, yes. You were a bit of a catch.
Yes.
And what were you looking for?
Well, I mean, it's not a question of who you're looking for. You just have to take what his story was about, as far as he was concerned, what he'd done and all the rest of it, and just leave it at that, because it was something that only time would tell whether how good a pilot he was.
Now, this first one, did you get any chance, because there's an accident, isn't there? There's an explosion. Yeah. You end up in hospital.
Yeah.
So there's this explosion. Now, what is this explosion? This is your first crew. There's no point going into it, because you weren't with them long, were you?
No, this is something that happened to me. I was going to fly with this particular pilot and crew, right? I'm fixed up, but I didn't fly with him. In the meantime, I was down to fly with him. I was involved in an accident. And I'll have to read this to you, because it is important to tell you how near I was to death at that time. It was it happened on the 8th of July, and part of my instruction at the time was to have a lecture on a G-box, which is an additional electronic device for navigators, but which we had to learn as well. The chappy who was giving the demonstration had warned everybody that whenever you go near the G-box, make absolutely sure it's in the safe position before you operate it, because as soon as you put the switch down, it will explode. He said, if you don't put it in the safe position and somebody just switches it down, it will explode in the aircraft. So the warning was there to us. And he was giving us this demonstration. He said, always make sure that it's in the off position before you even look at it. You won't believe this, but he put the switch down and it exploded. Now, we were sat, me and my friends, we sat on the front row. And this was only about the distance from here to, say, where the garage is, a bit further along there.
So about away. 10 feet. So we're about 10 to 12 feet at most.
So with that, but I felt being hit here and here.
So on that head and chest.
So little bits of metal or whatever it was that were made of. And it had gone all along the front row, got the most of it, and they'd all got bits and things that had happened to them. So, of course, he was in a very bad position. He was in a very badly injured. And, of course, they had to get the ambulance and get us all to cut a long story short, I was transferred, and my pal was transferred to the Seer Green Hospital, the Halton Hospital, which is a Queen's nursing establishment, and we were kept in there for 2 weeks.
Now, when had this accident occurred again?
On the 8th of July.
So you were there 2 weeks in July?
Yeah, that's right. And then we were kept in for 2 weeks, followed by a week's convalescence.
Now, how bad were you? How much damage did the
bit? Not too bad, but they had to dub. One was up here, and one was. The other one was.
The one was on your forehead? My forehead.
That's right, one was up there. And I think one was here.
Just below the
Yeah,
hands.
That's right. And when I was finally discharged, and I came back to join my crew, they found out that he wasn't there anymore. He'd been killed. And apparently what had happened is that they'd gone off the training exercise, found another wireless operator in my absence, and they did a series of exercises, what they call circuits and bumps, just going around the perimeter of the airfield. And suddenly the pilot, for some reason, actually lost control, and he hit a tree and crashed onto the roof of a house in Winslow High Street. And all the members of that crew were killed. And that could have been me. So I've always recorded that because there's another thing. Apparently it was a very bad crash because in addition to the crew, 13 civilians and some children were also killed. So it would have been massive. So that's the escape that I had there.
Now, just while we're at it, I mean, yeah. I do see. I mean, that's quite. It is a big escape.
Yeah.
But what was the G box? Can you explain a bit about what it was for and how it operated?
The G box.
It sounds a bit dangerous.
No, it doesn't. It's a very good piece of equipment.
So what was it for?
What it is, it's that when you go over Germany and you quite often will find on the wireless you're getting. Interrupted by jamming. We do our share of the jamming, and the Germans do their share of trying to interfere if you're using your wireless by putting something in operation which will jar or stop your message getting through. However, on this occasion, with the G-Box, what is used? It's used by the navigator. Now, the navigator, if we're getting, he's tracking a course, and he's got a course all laid out on his table. And if there's any interruptions at all through the flight, the bomb aimer, he liaises with the bomb aimer, and between them, they think that they are off course by a certain amount, so they get the check with the G-box. And the G-box will usually tell them if they're off course or not by certain information that they give them.
Do you know how it works?
I don't know, because we were never taught how to use it. All we were taught was how we shouldn't do anything with that G-box at all, because and to make it, as far as we were concerned, make sure that if you did have to go and use it for whatever reason, you made sure that the switch was in the off position, because as soon as you switch it down, obviously, it would just do what its job was.
Did you ever find if this instructor had switched it off and it was faulty, or whether it was
no,
off?
It wasn't faulty.
It
was all right. Oh, it just had a lack of concentration, and because he was giving a lecture to us all, was concentrating on what he was lecturing, and giving out to everybody that he'd probably he'd forgotten that for some reason, which I find really can't understand, he'd obviously left it in the on position. And so consequently, through that accident, it saved me, because I would have been with him on that training exercise.
Now, you form another crew, don't you?
Oh, yes, that's right,
this
yeah.
is with a man called, is it Frank French?
That's right, that would be my pilot, yeah. Yeah.
Now, tell me what he, I mean, did he choose you or did you choose
well,
him?
Well, what happened was, when I'd had the accident, one morning I was getting up from from the bed, and this character came over to me, and he said, "Is it Don Farrington?" I said, "Yes, it is." He said, "Well, I'm Frank French." He says, "I'm looking for a wireless operator, if you're interested." He says, "I know your records from what I've been told." "I'd like you to join us if you would." So I said, "Well, I don't know. As far as I'm concerned, I'm eligible to join you." And I liked him, actually, just speaking to him. He was a flying officer. He was not an NCO, a flying officer. And we got on very well. So I said,
"What was
yes,
he like?"
Very friendly. And I think he lived somewhere in the London area, if I remember rightly. But we decided, I said, "Well, we'll give it a try and see how we go." And I never had any problem whatsoever. He was so good. And
he was a good pilot.
He was a good pilot, yes.
Now, we go through the rest. Do you remember the rest of the crew? I've got them here in front of me. I can read them to you. But, I mean, do you remember them as individuals? There seems to be a flying officer, Yarwood, is that right? It's badly printed, so I'm not...
Yeah, Flying Officer Yarwood was our navigator. He was the old man of the... he was about 33.
And do you remember his first name? It looks like H.G.
It's...
Harold?
I think it was Harold, if I remember rightly. Yeah.
And what was he like? Was he a flying officer as well?
Oh, he was... yes, he was. He was very good, really. He got all kinds of humorous jokes to tell us. He used to be connected with the royal family. In as much as he used to be one of these people that not actually police, but people that were in charge of looking after certain members of the royal family. He used to keep telling us stories about them.
And a good navigator?
Oh yes, very good. Yeah.
Now the next one is the bomber.
That's Murray Hofberg.
Hofberg, that's what I've got, Hofberg. Yeah. Hofberg.
Yeah.
And he seems to be MM. I don't know what
Murray, his name is. Murray is his first
Murray.
Name. Yeah.
So Murray Hofberg. Now, what was Murray Hofberg like?
He was a bomb aimer. He was a very typical Canadian, very full of himself, in a nice way. He was always one after to the ladies. He was very good-looking sort of bloke.
So that's it. Then you were the wireless operator, air gunner, and then the mid gunner seems to be Sergeant Buchan, Jay Buchan.
Buchan, that's right, yeah.
And what was he like?
He was okay, very, very amenable. They all were, actually. We got on very well together, all of us.
Is it Buchan or Buchanan?
Buchanan.
Thank you. Yeah. Sorry, it's very, very unclear.
Yeah.
Do you remember his first name? Sorry. Jay, it is.
Oh, dear.
All right.
I'm not quite sure now.
That's fine. So Buchanan was... And then the last one is looks like Flight Sergeant S.T. Bulmer.
Yeah,
he's a rear gunner.
He's a rear gunner. Yeah, that's right.
What do you remember of him?
He was a quiet sort of individual, but he liked going to the pubs afterwards and enjoyed himself, I think. He was very quiet.
Now, you get an engineer, but you wouldn't get him then, would you?
Yes.
You got him then? Now.
Joe Cashmore, his name.
Joe Cashmore?
Yeah.
Now, what was he like?
Well, he was a typical Midlander. He was a broad Brummagem accent with him, like I've got a Lancashire accent. yeah, he was very good. We met up after the war.
Now, so that was your crew. Now, how did you get on together when you first met? Do you know what I mean?
We all got on quite well. I don't think there's any arguments about that. We all acknowledged we've got a job to do, and everybody was quite happy, and we just got on with our jobs individually, and whatever we were called on to do, we seemed to get through it all right.
Now, what were you flying?
This was the Stirling aircraft. Well, first of all, we did some training on Wellingtons.
That would be at 2602.
That's right, yeah.
Tell me about the Wellington, because it's a famous old... Well, it's not old.
Well, the Wellington, I would have hated again to have done operations on them. There was not much room inside. And I don't know. I think with the four-engine aircraft, you see, you've got a lot more room. And I think it does make a difference.
So what sort of training flights were you doing in the Wellington?
Well, just, I would say, like country sort of trips going.
Did you do the circuits and bumps with them? Or had
you do those, but you also do a few flights for an hour or so, or perhaps even 2 hours at the most, going to different parts of the country and doing them and logging the time it's taken and what the weather conditions were like and also testing the wireless operating vehicles. While you're in the air, you can contract who you like. You've got all the frequencies to call and to give you plenty of exercise. You're forever getting through to different stations that you've got the code number for, and that is your practice when you're flying on with other aircraft.
Now, you then seem to go to... Now this seems a bit aside. You go to Lake and Heath for this is something separate, isn't it? This is in September. You go back and you go to Lake and Heath for ground training. Now, what's this about?
Well, this is to do with escaping, to a certain extent.
Evasion. And
evasion. Things. That's right. What they do, they take you out in a truck, all of you, the crew, it's the glass is all darkened, so you can't see out. You have no idea where you're going, and you've been taken out for quite a few miles from where your station is. So then they drop you at a certain place, and you all have to get out, and then you all have to go at different times and find your way back to the airfield without being caught by any of the people that was guarding the airfield, which was all the way around it. So somehow or other, your job was to get through and get as though you were going to do some damage to the aircraft and to see whether you're good enough at getting it done. So that was the exercise. Now, all I can remember is I got to a certain point, because it was a question of whether you were going in the right direction, because you were outside your normal area, don't forget, and there was a lot of country.
It's a lake in Heath,
a lot of countryside there, so a lot of villages that you're going through. So, and there's no signpost, don't forget, the signposts are all down. So, you've not got much to go off. I remember that I must have had a stroke of fortune. I got as far as the edge of the airfield, because I could recognise it, but so much was going on, I ended up in somebody's back garden, and they came out, and then it was all over, because somebody said, well, what are you doing here? So I had to explain what was happening, so I didn't get through, but I got to the airport itself, which was something, but that's what that was for.
And there also seems to be some unarmed combat parachute drill, and as well as the escape exercise. Do you remember that at all? You didn't jump in a parachute, did you? I mean, you may have done when you crashed, but I mean, sorry, you were hit.
Oh, we never had any training to use it. We were told how to use it and what to do when we had to bail out. That was all instilled into what we had to do. But the actual going out of an aircraft, no. But the unarmed contract, I can't remember that at all. They must have been very small or whatever it was. Perhaps.
And what about on the firing range? Do you remember that? Firing weapons? No.
No, I don't remember.
So to you, what you remember is the evasion, escape and invasion. Yeah. That's what
I don't remember much about that at all. But I knew that it did happen.
Now then you go to 1651 conversion unit.
That's right. That's when we converted just
Waterbeach.
That's right.
Now tell me about that.
That's the first introduction to a four-engine aircraft we had. And that was, to me, when I got to my seat in the Stirling, I thought, this is for me. It was wonderful space, like nothing like it. It was wonderful. And I had a steel back up to the head height for my back in the seat that I was sitting in. And I felt rather comforted with all this steel plating behind my back.
And what did you think of this? I mean, so it's comfortable. That's
now,
the first thing. But what else about it?
The Stirling aircraft had one or two faults, which is unfortunate. One was the fact that this is according to the pilot, it would swing a lot on takeoff and had to be handled very, very carefully when it was taking off, especially when you got a full load of bombs on. And quite a few of them had unfortunately lost control when they were about to take off and unfortunately ploughed in, and of course the bombs were on, and that was it. And there were quite a few accidents like that. So first of all, you had to be a very good, accomplished pilot to make life easy, that when you were going off, you countered the fact of a swing that would be either to port or otherwise. I wouldn't know quite exactly what that was causing it, but it was something due to the makeup of the aircraft. And that was one of the major faults with it when it was built. And they all acknowledged this after. But the second, and probably as much as important as the first one, is the height. The height we could get would be no higher than about 15 or 16,000. If you got to 16,000, you would be very, very lucky. Now that meant that the problem was, whenever we went on these major operations of any kind and Lancasters were involved, they went to 22,000 feet. So you can imagine bombing at the same time as Lancasters and Stirlings. They were up there and we were down here. And it wouldn't be the first time, unfortunately, the bombs that were dropping from the Lancaster would hit the Stirling. Now, I'm not saying that happened all the time. Obviously, it didn't. But it was a calculated risk because our height. I think what they tried to do was to establish that the Lancasters went out either ahead of us or behind us, one of the two, so they weren't there roughly about the same time that we would be there, and that would help to save the situation. So those were the two faults.
What about the rest of it?
Apart from the rest of it, it meant that you could do practically anything. In the case of avoiding attacks, you could throw that aircraft all over the sky. It was absolutely wonderful what they could do with it. Even the pilots would admit that. They knew the faults.
Now, did you practice evasive?
Oh, yes.
Tell us about that. Is it the corkscrew? But anything you remember?
Yeah, the corkscrew was quite an experience, where he puts his nose right down and he's going down at a terrific speed. And then suddenly he has to suddenly make a switch and turn, and then, my God, you feel everything goes up in the air. You can't visually stop it. It means that you've got to just let it go. And equipment go off where it should be, and unfortunately, it's not something that's practiced, as you can imagine, very often.
Did you practice it?
It was only just a few occasions.
Well, you did practice it with the conversion unit, did you?
Yes.
And any other evasive manoeuvres, or was that the main
one? No, that was the main one.
What sort of things were you doing at Water Beach, at the conversion, heavy conversion unit?
Well, we're going on what they call bullseye operation, or the different types of names of operations.
And
they were all training operations. You were going doing a certain thing. You were given a map and you were given the references as to where you've got to be at a certain time, and you've got to be in a position to be able to do some bombing. You didn't actually do it. You would actually be in the situation where you were ready to do something, and by you're always timed by it, the length of time. You've got to take account, not me, but they've got to take account of the wind and the weather conditions that they're going through all the time, all the way around. And if there's anything that's untoward, they have to report it back. So all these were exercises which helped to build up your method of how you get from A to B, and then what you do when you get to B, so that it will become, when you get an operation to go either to France, Belgium or Germany or wherever, you would have your map outlay. That would be the navigator, and the bomber would liaise with the navigator from time to time, and they are the ones that would map out the route which would be sort of given out to them by the people that were in charge of each operation.
And these would be long distance flights, would
they?
Oh
yes, yeah.
So how long? As long as...
Well, it depended on which part of the country you're going to. I would say the longest we ever went to was a 7-hour journey altogether. That was the longest. But it depended, as I say. You see, with some of them, if you were going to the far points of Germany and things like that, those were quite long trips. They could be double figures.
So your practice ones would be long.
But
as well.
The longest we think we did was 7 hours on an operation.
Oh, no, I mean on the practice.
No, I didn't think went that long.
So how long did you go in the practice? You know, these.
Well, mostly on the practice rounds, I would say about 2 to 2.5 hours or thereabouts on average. On the routine ones in England.
So just getting you used to it rather
well,
than...
Well, you're going to different points, north, east, south or west of all the British Isles. If you take the British Isles into it, you could be going in any direction and you can go down any route within that area. You wouldn't be going anything outside that area.
Now, anything else about the heavy conversion unit, or is that about it? You were there until November, so just a month really.
Yes, no, it wasn't there very long. We just get in the pilot mainly. See, like things like the gunners and me in the wireless operator, we were only doing what we've already done before, whichever aircraft you're in. So it was just getting used to acclimatised to where you were sitting. But from a pilot, it was the most, the most difficult side of his training was getting used to the change of aircraft. Because it needed an awful lot of handling, and every now and again we had a landing which he knew wasn't him. We would be bumping up and down several times on the runway. We could get down all right, but it was, you know, he'd not made as good a landing as, you know, normally, if you can understand it. It's like a civilian aircraft, when it comes in to land, you very rarely get any bumps. It's just a soft, smooth landing where both tires hit the concrete at the same time. Now, this on operation, or this on training, doesn't always happen because it's different types of aircraft, more powerful types in one respect, because you've got four different engines to involve, which obviously affects the balance of the plane. If they're not operating, that's the other thing. If you get a faulty one, it has been known for a Stirling to get back on one engine after being hit. Now that is quite something, considering the weight of the aircraft. It's quite considerable.